You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We keep hearing that children are being overdiagnosed with and over-medicated for mental disorders, that parents are over-anxious and schools are too demanding, and that normal, high-spirited kids are being too hastily labeled as having ADHD and other conditions. When Judith Warner set out to investigate these notions, she found a very different story. A paperback edition of her book, We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, has just been published by Riverhead, and I'm very pleased that it brings Judith Warner to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You set out to write a very different book, and you ended up writing this one. What happened?
Well, I set out to write a book precisely on this topic of overdiagnosis and overmedication, about how, you know, crazy, competitive, perfectionistic parents were finding fault in their kids when they didn't live up to their expectations, and then pathologizing them and getting them bogus treatments in order to try to get them to be more high performing, which was a very easy book idea to sell because it's what a lot of people already think. I certainly thought it. And when I set out to actually report this book, though, when I set out to back up the received wisdom that I had taken in with actual fact, I found that it was all but impossible, and found that I really had to rethink my ideas and come up with another way of looking at the issue that was reality-based.
Well, when you started reporting, did you find any of those stories of children wrongly diagnosed and parents who were too hastily seeking medication?
Children who were wrongly diagnosed, absolutely. You know, the story of poor care in our country is a very real and very important story, and one that we need to engage with. So wrong diagnoses, absolutely. Poor treatments, absolutely. Children who were too quickly given medication, or rather parents who rushed to give their kids medication, absolutely not. Parents didn't want to medicate their kids.
So why do you think this story is so persistent?
I think for a number of different reasons. I think part of it is that we're very quick to think the worst of parents these days. I think a lot of us dislike, are tired of, have had enough of the parenting culture of our time, the sort of competitive, high-pressure world that so many of us are bringing our kids up in and find pathological. And I think it's very easy to assume that the pathological nature of our times are playing out symptomatically in kids.
But we also have a notion that many people in the media then go out and try to find examples of to prove a point after the fact. And we had all of this sense of parents wanting certain things for their kids. That was the conventional wisdom. So you then go out and prove that.
Well, I also think that the whole phenomenon of giving kids medication for mental health disorders, even recognizing that kids have mental health disorders, is relatively recent, is not something that was widely known or done, certainly, when we were all growing up. So it seems like this whole issue of kids having issues is something new that springs from our times, and it's hard to get our minds around.
Well, if it's so pervasive, what kind of response did you get when the book was published in hardcover last year?
I got a rapturous response from the mental health community, from professionals, from parents of kids with issues, from people who are kind of dealing with this on a day-to-day level and felt like finally somebody understood what they were actually going through, where they were coming from, and what it was that they were trying to do. And I think probably the most gratifying response I've had are parents who say, you know, there are five people I have to give this book to so that they'll finally understand.
But there must have been other people who were just outraged that you were saying something like this.
I think they were kind of fatigued in their outrage because I'd been saying similar things in the New York Times for about 2.5 years. So they were used to it by then. They had already called me a shill for the drug companies, and it had gotten a little bit old. So I expected an outraged response, you know, in that sense. But it was actually pretty muted.
Do you think that this kind of pathologizing and medicating kids has the idea of it has grown out of a skeptical view of psychiatry and, as you suggest, the way that the drug companies work?
Absolutely. You know, I think that this way of thinking and telling this story has roots that are valid and that we have to kind of grapple with and deal with and talk about, which is that many of the marketing practices of the pharmaceutical industry have been reprehensible, which is that we have not had access to reliable research over the years. The government has fallen down on its job of being a buffer between the interests of the pharmaceutical industry and the interests of consumers. So there is an enormous amount of distrust. We know that negative studies were suppressed. We know that we haven't had full access to information. So there's a lot of distrust for good reason, but it's become overgeneralized. And there's also, I think, a longstanding and pervasive anti-psychiatry in our culture.
But hasn't part of the concern come from people who are worrying that medications like Ritalin are just a way of making these kids easier to control?
Yes, and I think that that's the most pernicious part of this thinking. Partly, it's a very simplistic view of what ADHD, which Ritalin is used to treat, actually is. And this is something that's been reinforced by the media over and over again. The idea that it's a disorder of wiggly boys, you know, spirited children, children who are badly behaved. You know, you look around and we all know that children are energetic and high-spirited. And we also look around and we know that a lot of children are really badly behaved today, really undisciplined, really obnoxious. And so it makes sense then to think, okay, we've got rampant bad behavior. We've got all this use of medication we didn't have before, the two to go together. But ADHD is such a more complex disorder. I mean, it's a disorder of executive functioning, of all of these different kinds of elements that then don't get talked about. Learning issues. I mean, there's inattentive ADHD where the kids aren't badly behaved at all and they're not hyperactive at all. You know, it's so much more complex than that. It impacts children and adults' lives in so many other ways. You know, we do these people such a great disservice when we simplify it down to this one narrow definition.
I guess one of the reasons is there was no such thing as ADHD when I went to school. There were just some kids who were a bit more lively than others, some kids who had certain problems being socialized, and that was just part of the mix.
That's right. And yet kids who have ADHD are not necessarily kids who are livelier than others or more spirited than others. They may be the kid who can't learn to write, the kid who's very smart but can't do a basic page of math. It might be the kid who can't connect socially because she misses the social cues. You know, it could be all kinds of things that defy that stereotype. Now, there were kids when you were growing up who were being diagnosed daily as dumb or bad, who weren't dumb or bad, but who had problems that were beyond their control and there was no understanding for them whatsoever.
Dyslexia, for example.
Exactly.
Autism has been diagnosed at a much higher rate in the last few decades than it was previously. The other day I heard a figure on television, 1 in 110. It used to be 1 in thousands, and then it was 1 in 250, now 1 in 110. Are we seeing an epidemic, or are we just diagnosing more and more things as being on the autism spectrum?
I think I've heard the number even as high you're right, 1 in 110 would be the high. That's the biggest number
I've
heard.
That's a lot of kids.
It's a lot of kids. You know, I think that the answer to this, as with so many elements of the story, is that it's very complex. A big part of it is changes in diagnostic patterns. You know, the definition of autism that we have today dates from 1980. Asperger's wasn't in the DSM until 1994. So you had kids who were not categorized as autistic before. They were categorized most often as either mentally retarded or schizophrenic. You know, there are researchers in California, for example, who did a study looking at data from public schools and found that in the era of the great increase in autism diagnoses in California, you had an exact shift in the number of kids diagnosed as mentally retarded to the number of kids diagnosed as autistic. So you had a certain amount of simply diagnostic substitution. There are also people who do believe that there really is a rise in the prevalence, in the real prevalence of autism. And the question is why? But certainly that's just one piece of a complex picture.
Is this happening all over the world or just in this country? I'm talking about the full range, ADHD, autism, the growth of bipolar diagnosis.
To the extent that people are using the same diagnostic categories as we now are in this country, and that these disorders are being diagnosed more frequently and defined in the same way that they're being defined here, then necessarily we're seeing the same shift around the world because the same paradigm shift has happened.
A listener, Suzanne, left this comment on our show page. As the mother of a child with several diagnoses, I too thought that he was over-medicated. However, now that he willingly does not take his medication, I see how necessary it is for him to take them. Parents really have it difficult. But kids with these disorders, for those kids, it's even harder. It's almost as if we were losing our children who are still alive.
That's a beautiful way of putting it, losing our children who are still alive. I've heard it said that way so many times, particularly when you have a child with depression. You know, it's like seeing their soul stolen away. And it's horribly painful for parents. And I guess this is why I have such an emotional response at this point now to the, oh, my God, they're all being drugged storyline. It just is so utterly lacking in empathy and compassion for what parents are going through.
Well, we've seen this explosion of autism. We now have ADHD. What used to be manic depression is now bipolar disorder. Do you think that there are other conditions that don't have names or are not fully understood yet?
Well, it sounds like, I mean, I know the hope within psychiatry is that the whole system of naming disorders is going to change over the coming decades. You know, we now have a way of naming disorders according to symptoms. We don't name them according to underlying biological processes the way you do, let's say, with other kinds of diseases. I mean, we don't talk about a form of heart disease as chest pain syndrome. You know, you talk about it in terms of what's actually going on with the heart. And the hope is that the understanding of these disorders is going to increase and become more precise so that you can identify the actual biological process that's going wrong and then categorize the disorders in terms of the biological processes. But we're not there yet.
Many believe our society, the stress, anxiety, push to perform and succeed, overscheduling kids with schoolwork, extracurricular activities, is making these children sick. Is there any evidence of that?
I think that's an interesting question. I just want to come back to your last question for one moment. You know, with autism, we may see another one of those shifts, because there is that debate now for the DSM-5 of not considering Asperger's, or rather not having Asperger's as a separate category, considering it high-functioning autism, the idea being that, you know, it belongs in one place or another, and all
of
that.
It may be a mirror of autism rather than on the autism spectrum.
So I think that we will see changes in the future that will change along with greater understandings of the different disorders, and that will be an area undoubtedly where we're going to see a change in numbers again according to how the definitions play out. So it'll be interesting to watch. I thought from the beginning, coming to your later question, that certainly the way we were living, the kind of frenetic, high-pressure pace, had to be causing pathology in kids. I mean, how could it not? It causes pathology in me when I have to drive, you know, from one activity to another. But I mean, the fact that I could even make that sort of stupid joke shows the problem of that whole way of thinking. You know, there's sick, quote unquote, when you talk about a sick way of living, and then there is actual pathology. Then there are actual, you know, states where something is going wrong. Something has risen to the level of being a diagnosable condition. Being stressed is not a mental illness. Depression is a mental illness. Being somewhat anxious, somewhat nervous is not a mental illness. Having an anxiety disorder to the point where it impedes your daily functioning is a mental illness. And, you know, yes, kids are stressed out. Yes, maybe the way we live isn't optimal. But it doesn't mean that all kids are now sick with anxiety or stress. Some kids have inborn temperaments, predispositions. Certainly the way we live probably doesn't help anybody, but it's way too simplistic to say that because we schedule them for too many, I don't know, team sports and SAT prep, that they're getting sick.
Judith Warner is the author of a number of books, also writes frequently for the New York Times and other publications. And her latest book is We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, now available in paperback from Riverhead Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Judith Warner, whose latest book is We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, now available in a paperback edition from Riverhead Books. What kinds of stories did parents tell you when you were researching this book?
You know, there were stories that just broke my heart. One that really stands out in my mind was, and made me so ashamed, you know, of my initial way of conceiving of this book, you know, that parents were just rushing to medicate their kids for nothing. There was a little boy, for example, who had always been anxious, who had separation anxiety, and who one morning was just being so difficult because he couldn't find his shoes for school. And his mom was looking, and then she said, well, here are your sneakers. Just wear your sneakers. They're fine. And he's like, no, 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 no. And she said, why does everything have to be so difficult with you all the time? And he said, Mommy, you don't understand. If I don't wear those shoes, you're going to die today. You know, these were the kind of stories.
Right, it was OCD.
Right. These were the kind of stories parents were telling me, you know. And in that case, the woman wanted to take him to a psychiatrist. And her husband said, you know, I just don't feel comfortable having a child of mine see a psychiatrist. And she said, you know what? You're going to get comfortable with it because this is what's happening.
Well, I would think that in New York, where a lot of people have been to psychiatrists, it wouldn't be as big a problem as it might be in other parts of the country where psychiatry or some kind of therapy is looked upon still with a lot of suspicion.
I think logistically it's easier in New York. I think that no matter what, it's extremely difficult and painful for people to see or acknowledge that there's a serious problem with their child.
And they're afraid, because of the cliches of psychiatry, the parent is going to be blamed.
They always blame themselves. Even though psychiatry has moved on, even though the thinking within the profession has changed, they generally don't blame parents anymore. Pediatricians generally don't blame parents anymore. Parents' first instinct still is to blame themselves.
What percentage of kids is actually being treated with medication for mental disorders? Do we know?
5% of American kids.
So it's a very small percentage, even though we hear that everyone is being medicated.
Exactly. It's a small percentage, and it's also a percentage that is not at all out of line with the believed prevalence of mental health disorders in kids, which range in government figures from 5 to 20%. The 5% being the kids who are the most severely affected, the 20% being those with milder conditions.
Let's talk about ADHD, which, as I said earlier, wasn't even a condition 30 years ago. What is it? Do we know what it really is? And how is it any different from a kid who just has a lot of energy or is easily distracted?
Well, it's a disorder of ability to sustain attention, a disorder of impulse control a lot of the time. You know, there's a long checklist of symptoms that then, you know, kids' symptoms kind of fall into different patterns. With some kids, there's a hyperactivity piece of it. With some kids, it's mainly inattention. With some kids, the executive functioning part of it is the main part of the disorder, the ability to sort of decide in what order and how you're going to approach something. With some kids, it plays out very strongly socially, maybe the impulsivity part, maybe the inattentive part. And the understanding and conception of this has changed so much over time because it was first – it's been recognized, I mean, certainly since the 19th century, and even there are reports from earlier that some kids are hyperactive, bizarrely hyperactive. You know, even in the 20th century, you had the notion of minimal brain dysfunction. You had in the old DSMs and Freudian terminology descriptions of words that contained hyperactivity. Everything was a reaction, but a hyperactive reaction. But the notion of inattention as being the chief characteristic of ADHD didn't really come into the definition until 1980.
Of course, we also used to hear that kids were inattentive because they were smart and bored. And right. It's hard to tell the difference between the two, isn't it?
Well, if you're privileged enough to be able to afford really good diagnostic testing, you know, educational psychologists can do full batteries of tests that are actually able to break down various aspects of mental functioning to be able to look at what's going on in how a kid approaches work, approaches different situations, and can look at the different components of all of this.
So Ritalin and some other medications are given for ADHD, but don't some of these or most of these psychotropic drugs have significant side effects?
Yes, many of them do. All of them have some side effects. It depends on the kid. For some kids, they can't take them at all. I mean, the side effects are simply too severe.
And drugs can't be tested on kids.
Well, they can be tested on kids. And the drug companies have been given incentives in recent years to test them on kids. They can get an extra 6 months of patent exclusivity if they test a medication specifically in children. They don't have to, but there is this, you know, commercial incentive now. What we don't have are long-term studies to see what the long-term physiological effects, let's say, are. We just have reports from psychiatrists, let's say, who have been prescribing the medications for decades, who are able to talk about that.
Now, you focus primarily on middle and upper middle class parents. Do we even have this discussion for poor people?
We absolutely do. And I think once again, we have this discussion, and I discuss this quite a bit in the book, actually. We talk a lot about the over-medication of poor kids, of kids on Medicaid, and the over-medication of foster kids. There have been a lot of stories in the media about the rate, the use of atypical antipsychotics in foster kids. And you do see rates of use of these particular medications in kids on Medicaid and kids in foster care that are strikingly high. And it's, you know, questionable and problematic. And there are a number of state lawsuits about the use of atypical antipsychotics with kids and adults actually on Medicaid. But what's always missing in these discussions, though, first of all, is the realization that the prevalence of mental illness among kids in foster care is very high. So the kids have problems. The kids should be getting some kind of treatment. The real issue is that they're getting terrible treatment a lot of the time. Most kids in this country, you know, and not just poor kids, get no mental health care or really, really poor mental health care. And that's, frankly, what we really should be talking about and what we should really be thinking about. You know, so much energy goes into moralizing and hand-wringing about, isn't it awful they're all on drugs? Why aren't they getting good therapy? Why aren't we making that a cultural priority?
So you think that would be a reform, the therapy going along with the drugs? The pharmaceutical industry has come under a lot of scrutiny in recent years, especially the close relationship between some doctors and some drug companies, including drug companies paying doctors to promote their products. And I'm assuming that much of the discussion we've been hearing so far is a backlash as a result of all of these revelations, revelations that are definitely true.
The revelations,
I mean, 60 Minutes probably would lose one-eighth of its programming over the last 20 years if they didn't keep on telling these stories.
These stories are true, and I think that the pharmaceutical industry has absolutely shot itself in the foot. I think that by suppressing the studies, for example, that showed the dangers of Paxil, they shot themselves in the foot. You know, the use of SSRIs then dropped, and the use of atypical antipsychotics in kids then increased as doctors were afraid to prescribe SSRIs and were distrustful of the data about their efficacy and also their safety.
My guest is Judith Warner, whose latest book is We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, now available in a paperback edition from Riverhead Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You spoke with Dr. Peter Kramer, a professor of psychiatry at Brown University, who wrote the bestseller Listening to Prozac in 1993. What did he tell you about the use of psychiatric drugs in this country?
He's always an interesting person to talk to because he always has kind of contrarian take on things. And, you know, we talked about the trope of over-medication, the over-medicated child. You know, what does the persistence of the idea that we have this grossly over-medicated population actually say about us? He had done research in the late 70s into the use of Valium in women, the belief that women were being just grossly over-medicated with Valium, and that this was a way of keeping them down and, you know, not listening to them, shutting them up. And he had done this research for the Carter administration. And he found, in fact, that, you know, there was some overuse of Valium, but also that the people using Valium very often had real problems. And, you know, they weren't getting good treatment. They were getting poor treatment, let's say, because Valium wasn't an appropriate course of treatment for them. But it wasn't necessarily a question of a woman with no problems being given Valium in order to shut up. And, you know, this as a kind of structure for looking at this story works perfectly for what's happening with the trope of the medicated child today. The idea is that perfectly normal children are being given drugs to shut them up and make them behave and make them like square pegs fit in this, you know, round hole of a pathological society. There are a lot of kids who really do have problems. There are a lot of kids who are getting really crummy treatment. They are getting too much medication. They're getting multiple medications. They're not getting comprehensive care. They're not being seen for who they are. All that is true, but it's also true that they need help.
What have we learned from what happened in Nebraska in 2008? It announced a law that allowed parents to drop off babies at safe havens like hospitals, and parents are dropping off troubled kids mostly.
They were dropping off teenagers. It showed the absolute desperation that parents of kids with mental illness were experiencing. They couldn't get care for them. And finally, they were dumping them in Nebraska so that they could get state-funded services because they didn't know what to do with them anymore. They literally couldn't get them into treatment programs. You know, there have been this great reduction in the number of hospital beds, you know, in psychiatric institutions, especially for kids, because of the use of medications, because kids are able to be treated at home, which in and of itself could be a good thing if they were getting wraparound services, but they're not. And parents very often are absolutely desperate. Some of them put their kids in foster care so that they can then get the mental health care that they couldn't on their own.
Part of the problem is that special education programs, especially for kids with autism, are very expensive. And so states right now finding themselves tight for money have cut back on those services, and nobody seems to know what to do with these kids.
There's also the problem that there's such terrible competition for resources. Special ed programs are extremely expensive, and the budget comes out of the, you know, the general budget for everyone, and that breeds a lot of resentment and a lot of feeling that, you know, some kids are getting special treatment. Some people's kids are getting added advantages that other people's kids aren't. And that feeds, I think, a lot of the distrust and the sort of nasty, well, there's really nothing wrong with these kids kind of thinking.
Are the schools turning out a lot of child psychologists?
No, they're especially not turning out child psychiatrists. There are 7,000 child psychiatrists in the country.
7,000?
7,000.
In the whole country?
Yes. That's a tiny number. So is it any surprise then that so many kids are getting poor mental health care? And a lot of those, I would say possibly the majority, don't participate in health insurance. So kids aren't getting to them one way or the other. Same for child psychologists.
Philip in New York City wrote, "I'm a 53-year-old adult who was only recently diagnosed with ADD. I grew up thinking that I was just stupid. As it turns out, I have a very high IQ and fell into depression as a child because I could not meet my potential. The great news is that I discovered treatment with neurofeedback after a few years of riding the roller coaster." I have sometimes there are misspellings in these things, and I have to figure him out on the fly. A few years of riding the roller coaster of medications, neurofeedback uses radio waves to stimulate the brain, has fine-tuned my brain to attend to what is in front of me. I wish neurofeedback was more widely used for children.
And I wish that the NIMH would sponsor studies of alternative therapies like neurobiofeedback and others that are discussed. There's auditory listening therapy, and there are other alternative therapies that parents are very interested in that don't require the use of medication or that can maybe lessen the dosage of medication. And there is no good research. There's just no good research. It's very expensive, and it's not reimbursed by health insurance. And I have heard good stories about neurobiofeedback. But it's really, you know, you're talking at many thousands of dollars for that. And, you know, it isn't clear that it works for everybody. And so that's a difficult choice for parents to make.
On the other hand, since so many of these conditions continue into adulthood, wouldn't it be best to throw some money at them when the child is young and might actually be turned around?
Absolutely. But the question is, if something like neurobiofeedback doesn't work,
I'm thinking about all of the different treatments. I mean, it's hard to get treatment, I know personally, for a kid with autism because it's so expensive. So there's resistance. You have to fight. And I always wonder whether society is being penny wise and pound foolish because it's going to cost a lot of money later when you have somebody who might have been able to have had some changes affected in their life, a ward of society for all of their life.
That's absolutely true. And I mean, as your listener wrote in, his ADHD went undiagnosed. He ended up falling into depression. I mean, this is what studies have shown, you know, a high percentage of people with ADHD, if they don't get treatment, they do end up becoming depressed, having other disorders. Anxiety correlates very highly with it. You know, there are all kinds of risks that come from non-treatment. We always talk about the risks of treatment, but we don't talk about the risks of non-treatment. And with mental health disorders, they can be very, very high. They can be suicide for some disorders.
Judith Warner's book, We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, now available in paperback from Riverhead Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.